at a Starbucks, don't forget to add the insurrection infusion fee. So the most important part of this, yes, he's meddling in Brazilian politics by imposing a tax on Americans. You and I are going to be paying higher taxes at Starbucks on juice, on all the things that we import from Brazil, and Brazil is a very important trading partner. In order to help the leader of a failed coup get off the hook. Remember, and this really highlights the absurdity in so many dimensions, actually, Nicole. But
meanwhile, in Brazil, they are now burning Donald Trump and the American flag as they protest Trump's 50% tariff. So much for the world respecting Trump and Trump's America. U.S. smashes records with $121 billion tariff haul. The U.S. has raked in a mind-blowing $121 billion in tariff revenue, obliterating all records, with another $27 billion surge expected for June 2025. Trump's aggressive trade policies are making America wealthy.
How much we've been collecting in revenues, and I did this in part because Wilfred's here and he can talk about the UK trade deal, but just this is the monthly numbers, and they have gone up a lot. June is actually set for another big increase of $27 billion. That is money coming into U.S. coffers from tariffs. We are collecting a lot of revenue. So far, guys, $121 billion has flowed into the U.S. government since the start of the fiscal year. It's still a tiny portion of the overall revenues that the U.S. government gets, but it's increasingly a lot, especially we haven't seen it in terms of the consumer paying off higher inflation.
Ishiba says the Japan should make more efforts to become independent from the United States in response to Trump's tariffs. This is huge. Japan has been a loyal vassal to the U.S. until Donald Trump.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure to be on your show. The imposition of these tariffs are very much likely to have different effects. First of all, of course, there is the economic impact. There will be trade disruptions. Both Japan and South Korea are major exporters of steel, aluminium, and other goods to the US. And the tariffs will raise the costs of American manufacturers that rely on these imports for locally produced American items, potentially leading to a supply chain disruption. There's retaliatory measures. Japan differs slightly because Japan is very cautious in retaliating. South Korea, however, have previously, back in 2018, negotiated quite harshly and got some exemptions from the US by agreeing to different quotas. But then again, if no deal can be reached, I'm guessing both nations, Japan and South Korea, will consider counter tariffs and maybe World Trade Organization complaints.
Which countries has Donald Trump singled out in regard to reciprocal tariffs? On July the 7th, the administration sent letters to more than a dozen countries threatening to raise tariff rates unless each secured trade deals with the U.S. by August the 1st. The White House didn't specify how the countries were chosen. Rates set in. The letters have so far ranged from 25% to 40% and are generally in line with the original reciprocal rates set out in April. Both Japan and South Korea, which together export millions of cars to the U.S., face 25% tariffs.
It can absolutely be described as economic bullying. Coercion over diplomacy.
That our country made $25 billion last month, $25 billion. haven't done that in a long time, and a lot of that's done because of good management, and number one, and maybe even more importantly, the tariffs that are pouring in. We have tariffs pouring in at levels that we have never seen before, and they've only just started.
Instead of sitting down and mutually negotiating something beneficial, which trade always should be beneficial for both involved parties, the U.S. is imposing tariffs by fiat and demanding compliance, demanding obedience.
But that's the reality of life, something we have to deal with. And I guess the best position for us is to stay united, to have the discussion among ourselves in closed settings, and to communicate in the open space with a very, very clear message. And I hope that that clear message will be, we don't want any kind of trade war. It is in no one's interest.
The threat of additional 25% tariffs in country, if the countries retaliate, is an explicit attempt to intimidate trading partners into submission. It's not fair trade. It's just a clear and present message from Trump and the United States. Accept our terms or we will try and crush your exports.
We're dealing with other countries and certain countries that would rather have a deal than a regular tariff. And we're willing, if they're willing to open up. These are countries that have been shut to us, but we've been open to them. In other words, they wouldn't let us do business there, but they would do business in our country. Not a fair deal.
This is not protectionism in a classical sense. This is more like economics strong-arming, forcing the smaller or slightly smaller economies to absorb the costs for America's failure without recourse.
I appreciate, though, that I was getting the heads up just before the letter was coming. And, of course, I clearly recorded my disappointment about this measure because it puts us into a totally different dynamic. But nevertheless, I felt also from my United States counterparts that despite that letter, they're ready to continue the negotiations. We, of course, will use that opportunity because I'm absolutely 100% sure that negotiated solution is much better.
This is the info news section of the program, China's mineral purchases, China buying up mines globally. Beijing is reportedly racing to lock in critical mineral supplies as the West restricts Chinese investments. Major deals reportedly included gold mines in Kazakhstan, Ghana, and the Ivory Coast, a copper mine in Zambia, a copper gold mine in Brazil, and a 50% stake in a rare earth project in Tanzania. China is the leading refiner of rare earths, responsible for 90% of global processing capacity, and holds the world's largest reserves of the critical elements. BRICS and national currencies. The Russian finance minister has said national currencies free BRICS from Western financial systems. Sanctions have accelerated the economic bloc's push for financial independence. Anwar's warning. Malaysia's Anwar warns of weaponized trade as Donald Trump's tariffs loom. Malaysian leader says trade being used to pressure, isolate, and contain. Across the world, tools once used to generate growth are now wielded to pressure, isolate, and contain. Tariffs, exports, restrictions, and investment barriers have now become the sharpened instruments of geopolitical rivalry. U.S. aid to Israel. Rep. Green wants to remove $500 million in military aid for nuclear-armed Israel from the NDAA. Green's comments mark a rare acknowledgement of Israel's nuclear weapons from a member of Congress.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the in-depth section of the program. The U.S. president's love for tariffs has been announced repeatedly by him. Countries have grown to dislike the bullying by the U.S. president, and even though this will generate money for the U.S. as it has, the key question is at what cost? President Donald Trump has said he will impose blanket tariffs of 15% or 20% on most trading partners. By doing this, he has dismissed concerns that further tariffs will negatively affect the stock market or drive inflation. What happens when those countries stop trading with the U.S.? What happens when they can trade between themselves fully and exclude the U.S. totally? This hammer-and-nail strategy is hurting American manufacturing much more than people think. Now, let's bring back our guest, Rodrigo Duval Ferreira, geopolitical analyst and lawyer. Rodrigo, even though the letters were not the final word from Donald Trump on tariffs, his tariff actions have threatened not only global economic stability, but also risking a slide into recessions and global downturn. My question, what alternatives are there to stop this?
As I mentioned on my previous answer, what is being threatened right now is not just Japan or Korea or China, because tariffs against China are still there in place. What is being threatened is world order as we used to know. So when new tariffs are imposed unilaterally, as is being done, it's the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs that is under threat. It is the WTO that is under threat. When military aggressions are done, as it happened recently, it's not Iran that is under threat. It's the security nations. It's the United Nations as a whole. So the world that as we knew of diplomacy, of rules, of order, somehow, it doesn't exist anymore. We were pretending it was still in place. It hasn't been for a while. It was not the first time that these things happened. It happened in the first, regarding tariffs specifically, it happened also in the first term of President Trump. So we're just seeing it over and over and less faking that we still have rules in place.
These are the words of Donald Trump leveled at BRICS. Any country aligning themselves with an anti-American policy of BRICS will be charged an additional 10% tariff. There will be no exceptions to this policy. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Let's not forget this started with one shock move. On April the 3rd, Trump announced sweeping new U.S. tariffs, 10% on everything, up to 50% for certain countries. Markets didn't wait. $2.5 trillion in market value gone in 24 hours. Now, let's bring back our guest, Mats Nielsen, legal historian. Mats, even though the letters were not the final words of Donald Trump on tariffs, his tariff actions have threatened not only global economic stability, but also risking a slide into recessions and global downturn. My question is, what alternatives are there to stop this?
Interesting question. I would say that there are a few ways to, if not stop, at least milden or dampen the effects. First off, you could have World Trade Organization challenges, thereby Japan and South Korea, the European Union, etc., they could file the WTO disputes against the U.S., arguing that the tariffs are violating the trade rules as such. And then Japan and South Korea, they could coordinate. They could form a joint response. For example, countries in Asia, which will be hit by tariffs, could get together and design collective counter tariffs, or perhaps coordinate subsidies to the effective areas of industry, forcing the U.S. thereby to negotiate. And then, of course, you have bilateral negotiations like the ones South Korea had with America back in 2018. So the individual countries will negotiate temporary exemptions while pushing long-term for better agreement with the United States. These are the positive actions. Then, of course, you have the decoupling actions, if you want to call them that. And thereby, I mean that Japan and South Korea needs to reduce its dependency on the U.S. market. So they would accelerate trade deals with the ASEAN Cooperation Council, or perhaps the Eurasian Cooperation Council, or the European Union.
What can be said that hasn't been said before on Trump tariffs? The most important thing when it comes to tariffs is what was said in the beginning of the program. The world is gearing up for a major transformation, a kind of reset. And if this takes place on a global scale, it would mean major economic realignment in which the U.S. would suffer economically, further declining its world standing. This is the Economic Divine. I'm Kyoresh Bunemati, and I'll see you next week.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many. Our love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice.
که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio this is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and then try to shed light and talk about some of these beautiful viewpoints About the conspiracy of America and Israel, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "The arrogant powers led by America seek to dominate the Muslim world and suppress the oppressed." Imam Khomeini's statement here reflects a critical perspective from a Shia viewpoint, that is, viewing Western, particularly Americans, influence as a form of imperialism aimed at dominating and suppressing the Muslim world. And you know, this aligns with the broader narrative of resisting tyranny and defending Islamic government. Islamic teachings emphasize resistance against oppression as well. You see, in the Holy Book of Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَتَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى and help one another in righteousness and piety. Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse number 2. You know, this verse encourages Muslims to stand against unjust powers that seek to exploit or subjugate them. And Imam Khomeini's words resonate with the concept that foreign powers, especially the U.S., have historically intervened in Muslim affairs to serve their interests, and often at the expense of Muslim dignity.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu
Narrations from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and infallible Imams alayhim assalam, they all highlight the importance of resisting tyranny. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The best jihad is speaking the truth before a tyrannical ruler." This underscores the importance of standing against oppressive regimes and external dominations. And furthermore, the concept of oppressed or mustadafin is central, emphasizing that Muslims must defend their rights against those who seek to suppress them. And Imam Khomeini's call can be seen as a call for awakening and resistance that is rooted in Islamic principle of justice and well-being. Imam Khomeini's words condemn external imperialist ambitions and reaffirm the duty of Muslims to resist oppression and uphold justice. And his words align with the Quranic injunctions and the teachings of the holy Imams alayhim assalam. Thank you very much, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every day, never forget to say.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be exposing the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's role in a grotesque plan to turn Gaza into what Donald Trump described as a Riviera of the Middle East. In our first report, Latif Rabachakra sets out some of the sordid detail of Tony Blair's squalid involvement.
News has emerged that the Tony Blair Institute has been involved in planning a post-Palestinian Gaza which would be marketed as a utopia on the sea. The organization has helped to draw up a map of how the strip would look, including a spot named after Elon Musk and the Trump Riviera. Rather than an abbreviation of his behavior, this is a continuation of his work over decades in war profiteering and directly serving Zionist aims. The Tony Blair Institute has, across the last few years, received at least £200 million from tech billionaire Larry Ellison. Ellison is a very close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu and even offered the Israeli Prime Minister dictatorship of his own data firm, Oracle, which processes the data of many UK government institutions. Ellison is also the largest funder of the Israeli military in history. He's a trusted friend of Elon Musk and lent him $1 billion, with which Musk obtained social media company Twitter. Tony Blair is currently a patron of the JNF with Netanyahu. The JNF is the largest settlement building organization in Palestine, and this was at the same time as being a peace envoy to Palestine. Tony Blair is also a special advisor for global affairs at Israel Lobby Group and Spy Network, the ADL. His wife, Cherie Blair, was also an ethical advisor to the Israeli intelligence firm NSO Group, behind the Pegasus spyware. Blair also has a long history of war profiteering in the Middle East. And after resigning as Prime Minister, Tony Blair was employed as an advisor to the oil company UI Energy. During the same period, UI Energy acquired 3 Iraqi oil fields. Tony Blair was paid around £1 million a year as an international advisor to an organization called the Mubadala Development Fund in the UAE. It was then reported that Mubadala developed a plan to mine $1 trillion worth of resources in Afghanistan. The Chilcot report also showed that Tony Blair lobbied George Bush on behalf of Siemens for access to power supply contracts in occupied Iraq just 3 months after the illegal invasion. Blair is a mercenary for hire, and he's working for Israel.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. And joining us once again as our guest contributor today is the highly respected and courageous award-winning British investigative journalist Vanessa Bealey. Welcome to the show. David, how would you appraise Tony Blair's post-Downing Street career?
Well, if you listened to the film there, you would have just heard a catalogue of appalling things that he's done, even just shortly after the invasion of Iraq. So he's effectively, as the film said, a mercenary, and he's been used as a sort of peace envoy at the same time as he's been making profits for himself and for others. He's been using his think tank to work for all sorts of dodgy clients, including the UAE and the Saudis and of course the Israelis in there as well. So this is a guy who killed 1 million people in Iraq and has subsequently made himself rich off the back of that huge and momentous crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Vanessa, I mean, what do you think motivates Tony Blair these days?
Israel motivates Tony Blair. I mean, if we go back even further in history to the balkanization of former Yugoslavia, Blair was instrumental in the weaponization of the Takfiri elements against former Yugoslavia. Those same Takfiri elements, of course, were then deployed into Syria and led to the eventual fall of Syria, one of the greatest and most historic supporters of the Palestinian cause. The fall happened in December 2024, and of course, Tony Blair's former chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, we find, was instrumental in the grooming of Jolani as the head of the al-Qaeda government or regime in Syria now, and leading the security war against the resistance axis, including Lebanon and the resistance factions in Iraq.
No, absolutely. Well, David, I mean, what's the significance then, do you think, of the tech billionaire Larry Ellison's relationship with Blair?
Well, look, Ellison's one of the top 10 or 15 richest people in the world, along with a whole bunch of other tech billionaires. And he runs a company called Oracle, which, of course, is effectively at the disposal of Israeli intelligence. He has ex-intelligence officers from Israel. Mm. Very senior in there, and Blair has helped him along the way. Oracle has contracts with the British government to the tune of billions a year, which means that Oracle provides cloud computing services for all of the critical national infrastructure of the UK, the NHS, the National Health Service, but also the Foreign Office, the Home Office, and the Ministry of Defence. So this is effectively a guy who's working for Israeli intelligence, who's very close to Blair as well, and who has managed to get access to what is effectively the critical national infrastructure of the UK, meaning that that the Israelis are able to penetrate all sorts of aspects of British governance and indeed, of course, of the security services and the intelligence services.
It's an example, isn't it, of sort of state capture, really. I mean, you know, they've got a guy here who's, you know, embroiled in the whole Israeli regime, you know, being responsible for key parts of the British state's infrastructure.
Well, we're talking about one billionaire here, right? And it's already alarming enough just to talk about that little bit of what this one billionaire is doing. But there are lots of tech billionaires who owe loyalty to the Zionists, whether they're Jewish or not. And this means that the whole of British politics and indeed American politics and of the whole tech world is, of course, captured by Israel in a very real sense. This is not some kind of hyperbole that we want to invent. This is actually how it works. It's not captured by China or Russia or Iran or any other power in the world. It's captured specifically by the Zionists.
And yet there is virtually no, well, I don't think there is any sort of adverse publicity about this, but when there was some talk about, you know, China's involvement with some key infrastructure in the UK. It was a huge, massive issue, wasn't it?
Sure, of course, that's led by the intelligence services who drip poison into the ears of receptive journalists, and then it becomes a huge issue in the press. Or, you know, the role of the IRGC it's supposed to have in the UK. Yes. All of this is dripped in by the intelligence services, whose priorities are, it appears, being set by the Zionists themselves.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Vanessa, I mean, do you think Blair's role in the so-called peace process then should be a cause for concern? And if you do, and I assume you probably do, you say why?
Well, of course, Blair's involvement in what can only be described as the genocidal project, it's no form of peace process whatsoever, is incredibly nefarious. And at the end of the day, Blair has been working towards this outcome for some time. I mean, everyone points at the first Trump administration as being the originator of the Abraham Accords. which, as David pointed out on X, is the Zionization of the countries that normalize relations with Israel. But in fact, it was Tony Blair that first introduced Yitzhak Molcho in London to a UAE cabinet minister. And in 2016, he engineered the meeting between Mohammed bin Zayed in Saudi Arabia and Netanyahu. So Blair was, if you like, laying the ground for the Trump administration and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, to bring in the Abraham Accords, which, of course, are designed to hand power over to the GCC Zionist bloc in the region and to weaken, if not destroy, the entire resistance axis.
Yeah, indeed. Well, David, I mean, do you think there's any prospect of this Gaza Riviera plan ever coming to fruition?
Look, we've talked in this program a lot in the last few months about the extent to which the Zionists have been able to have success in their military encounters with the Palestinian resistance, with Ansarallah, with Iran, and of course with Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance. And there are many ways in which when they face direct military face-to-face resistance that they lose. But they have also been very, very successful in some respects. So I think the question, in the end, the question is, it's in the balance, and it's in the balance, and it depends on what people do to resist Zionism. Because, of course, although they are now back in Gaza, having a really very, very bad time, the Palestinian resistance, the Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I mean, having a huge success with their operations in Gaza, it's quite extraordinary. It's not impossible that they will seek to expand their power in a way which we have hitherto not thought possible. That is, of course, is what the normalization Zionization process is about. It's about expanding their sphere of influence through the whole of the region, effectively running Saudi Arabia, running the United Arab Emirates, and that's what the project is. So it's not impossible that they will have more success in that area, and it really depends on what the resistance axis is able to do to stop that.
And talking about the resistance axis, Vanessa, of course, the events in Syria will have undermined the resistance axis, or its ability anyway, to resist, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Syria was the main land bridge for the transfer of weapons and assistance from Iran through Iraq and into Lebanon and Palestine. But Syria was also one of the primary manufacturers of the weapons, and particularly the missiles, used by the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance for decades and still being used. And now, of course, the weaponization, the security agreement between Jolani and Netanyahu, which is being strongly denied by the Syrian al-Qaeda regime but appears to be coming to fruition, is to use the Jolani Takfiri elements, particularly the foreign Takfiri elements, the Uyghurs, the Chechens, the Uzbeks, yes. Against Lebanon, they're not going to succeed in a war against Hezbollah, that's for sure. But what they can do is to occupy Hezbollah in fighting them on the eastern border and the northern border, while potentially Israel will invade from the south. And of course, this is all in preparation for the restarting of the aggression against Iran.
Yes.
And this is very clear as a result of the ceasefire that Israel will pivot towards weakening Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance before it replenishes its munition supplies and looks to restart some kind of aggression, whether it's hybrid or direct aggression against Iran.
Yeah. And just before we go to our next report, Vanessa, just say a word or two, will you, about the NSO group where Tony Blair's wife, Cherie, is an ethical advisor.
Well, I mean, you know, the NSO group is the manufacturer or the developer of the Pegasus malicious spyware, and it's no accident that Cherie Blair is involved in what could have potential alongside Oracle and, as David said, all of these other Unit 8200 Zionist intelligence operations that are infiltrating all sectors of Western society and Western governments. But the Pegasus spyware, of course, is being used or has been used in the past to surveil dissident politicians and journalists. And it's clear that this is one of the most potent weapons in the Zionist war box. that, of course, has been used against the Palestinian resistance. And we've been saying for a long time that what you've seen being weaponized against the Palestinians is eventually going to come home to roost in the West amongst the governments that have been supporting Israel in committing their genocide since 1917.
Sure, sure. No, indeed. Well, we're going to move to our next report now, which highlights just how deeply entangled with the Israel lobby Tony Blair really is.
Tony Blair is a very well-appreciated figure in Israel, said Israeli former Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, and how right she came to be. It's a little-known fact that Israel lobbyists were also key to Tony Blair's election as the leader of the Labour Party, and then even his election as UK Prime Minister, through his close relationship with Michael Levy, known as Lord Cashpoint. Simultaneous to fundraising for Blair, Levy also worked as a fundraiser for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and had a son, Daniel Levy, working for Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin. Blair was first introduced to Lord Levy by Israeli Embassy Officer Gideon Meir, while Blair was a humble shadow Home Secretary. Levy then set about raising funds for Blair, obtaining them from key Israel lobbyists like Trevor Chan, who funds Starmer and Lammy now, Emmanuel Kay, Labor Friends of Israel, and Chair of Westfield, Frank Lowy, who fought in the ethnic cleansing Haganah during the Nakba of 1948. Israel lobbyist Lord Levy also obtained a £1 million donation to Labour from Formula One boss Bernie Ecclestone, which had to be returned to avoid allegations of cash for favors. When in government, Tony Blair strong-armed Michael Levy into a position of influence at the Foreign Office as an unofficial envoy to the Middle East. Later on, once Prime Minister and knee-deep in service to the Zionist lobby, Blair delivered a speech at the annual Labour Friends of Israel reception in September 2006. I have never actually found it hard to be a friend of Israel. I am proud to be a friend of Israel, said Blair, now a long-time reliable asset.
David, I mean, as we've just heard in the report there, I mean, the Israel lobby played a significant role, didn't they, in getting Tony Blair the keys to 10 Downing Street and obviously therefore becoming the Prime Minister. I mean, what do you know about the role that they played?
Well, the fallout between the Labour movement and the Labour Party and the Zionist movement in the period between 1967 and 1993 or 4 or so, when Blair becomes the leader of the party, was quite significant. And the Palestinian, pro-Palestinian politics became much more important on the left. And you had in that period, in the 80s and 90s, you had all sorts of actions taken by the left against Zionism. But when Blair comes in, that's when that starts to change, and that's when you start to have the increased importance of Labour Friends of Israel, which of course had been in existence for some years. You have the role, in particular, of Michael Levy, who was introduced to Tony Blair by the Israeli ambassador. Mm. And they would then play tennis together, and he became known as Lord Cashpoint. He was his fixer. He would get the money in, and then, of course, he was given this, as we saw in the film there, the role in the Foreign Office. So this was a sea change in the way in which the Labour Party operated. So the Labour Party moved from a kind of social democratic position, skeptical about Israel and Zionism, to a position which was much more in favour of Thatcherite policies, neoliberal policies, but also much more in favour of Zionism. So it's a total change, and that's what we're seeing the after effects of now. And of course, the party became very disillusioned with that, and that's why they elected Jeremy Corbyn in 2015.
Yeah, indeed.
So that's the kind of arc of this. And of course, we're now back into a kind of on steroids pro-Israel position in the Labour Party.
Sure, yeah, no, indeed. Well, Vanessa, I mean, how does Tony Blair compare, do you think, to other prime ministers in the extent to which he embraced the Israel lobby?
I think, as David has just described, you know, Tony Blair was instrumental in empowering the Zionist movement in the UK and in UK politics. And, of course, we have to ask the questions with the Trump refusing to release the Epstein files, and now apparently we're told that Epstein killed himself, had committed no crimes, and Glenn Maxwell is in prison for nothing. We know that the Zionist movement works through systems of incentivization and compromising, in other words, blackmail. And there is not only one Epstein. There are probably thousands of Epsteins working globally. And I think the question has to be raised. All of these people, like Tony Blair, who was certainly one of the most prominent that was brought to power by the Zionist movement, to what extent is he compromised by the movement in some way? And I think, you know, investigations should be made into the potential for his compromisation in some way, but also what incentives are being offered to Blair other than power and status and influence and so on. And it's very clear from the Tony Blair Institute that now he's working very hard on embedding the GCC, Gulf Cooperative Council, so all of the Arab Gulf states, into the Zionist bloc. And I think that is one of his most important roles on behalf of the Zionist movement.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. But David, what about the role of Lord Levy in enlisting these kind of funders? I mean, our old friend Trevor Chin and Frank Lowy, for example.
Well, I mean, as I was saying about the about the role of Levy, he was Lord Cashpoint. He was the one who brought the finances. That Labour was not going to be critical of Israel. It was not going to challenge the wealth of the wealthy Jewish donors who were being tapped. And he was the one who brought all that to bear. And Chin, of course, is the most important of these in the sense that he's effectively and has been effectively since the 1970s the leader of the British Zionist movement. He's been at the head of the biggest Zionist charity, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, and it had previous names before that, since the 70s, or I think even further back than that, and he remains at the top of that organisation. So he is effectively the leader of the Zionist movement in the UK, and of course he has very strong links directly with the Zionist regime. And so you have the way in which this worked is that you have there's sort of different strands of Zionist funding for the political parties. So Levy brings in the ones who are traditionally favourable to a kind of moderate left neoliberalism. There are others who are much more conservative. And then you have some who are willing to play bipartisan. So, for example, Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, who's a hard-line Likudnik, but who will nevertheless fund the Labour Party if it has advantage for it.
Yeah, indeed, of course. Well, Vanessa, I mean, what was Israel's role in pushing for war in Iraq then, do you think?
Oh, I think, I mean, that you have to look at the Clean Break doctrine in 1997, which was effectively a strategy paper written by CIA operatives, commissioned by Netanyahu. And this was all about the partitioning of the Middle East or West Asia region into sectarian statelets that would be easier to manage for Israel and also potentially more sympathetic towards Israel. So this was the early, if you like, Abraham Accords plan. And then the war against Iraq was incredibly important to basically install U.S. military bases in Iraq to threaten both Iran and Syria. And in fact, from the Clean Break doctrine and commentary on the doctrine itself, we know that the road to Damascus was through Baghdad. So it was very important for Israel for Iraq to be effectively destroyed as a functioning resistant state to the presence of the Zionist entity in the region and to prepare for the war against Syria and then, of course, the war against Iran.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. And David, I mean, briefly, because I think we're nearly out of time, I mean, the son of Lord Levy seems to be getting quite a lot of pro-Palestinian airtime on Qatari-funded platforms, doesn't he? Are you buying that?
Well, no, of course, this is Daniel Levy we're talking about, who used to work for the Israeli government.
Yeah.
And now poses as pro-Palestinian. And he, some of the things he says, if I was to say them, I would be accused of being anti-Semitic and all the kinds of things that you say. So he says some stuff which is quite sensible in some respects, but of course there's a limit to the sense that he will do, and it's a limit which is effectively sympathetic to Zionism in the end. And I saw Levy, I was in Doha last year, I think it was, saw Levy there having a cozy lunch with Ben Jamal, the head of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, another organization which is soft on Zionism. And that's how this works. There's people who are appear to be pro-Palestinian, like Al Jazeera, sure, like Daniel Levy, like Ben Jamal, but actually they're effectively covertly working for the Zionists.
But what's Levy's game then, do you think, then, in terms of, you know, trying to kind of portray himself as...
Well, the Zionists want to work both ends of all games. That's what, and so when people say, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn couldn't possibly be a Zionist, look at all the pro-Palestine stuff he's done. Well, you see, well, actually, his position is a Zionist position, and the Zionists want to pressure from all sides, and that's why when the Zionists come for Jeremy Corbyn, people say, oh, he couldn't possibly be a Zionist. Well, the Zionists will play all sides of all games.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Vanessa Bealey, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 11,740 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Iran. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Greetings once again, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's what's waiting for you next on your radio station. We'll bringing you the very latest updates. It's time for our news segment this hour. Stay informed with the top headlines and breaking stories from around the world. After this, prepare for profound insights with Minbar. In this program, we present selected excerpts from the speeches of the renowned Islamic scholars, covering a wide range of topics including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and at times, social and political issues. Minbar brings the voices of the pulpit to life, timeless words that inspire thought, faith, and action. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. We sincerely hope you enjoy it. Finally, we present leaders' speech. Listen to English translations of the selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various occasions. A concluding moment of guidance and reflection. Up next is news this hour. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Over 100 Palestinian aid seekers have been killed in a single day in Gaza in what many see as Israel's blatant disregard for human rights and international law. The leader of the Ansarullah movement says Yemen will continue its firm support for Gaza by all means, including through military operations. And Iran says France, Germany and the UK lack any legal, political or moral standing to invoke the snapback mechanism of the 2015's nuclear deal. Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News. Gaza is witnessing yet another day of deadly Israeli attacks. Israeli airstrikes and shelling has killed at least 17 people in the past few hours. They were killed in airstrikes and shelling, including on an area west of Khan Yunis and in central Gaza. This comes a day after Israeli forces killed 115 Palestinians, including 92 civilians who were trying to access humanitarian aid. 8 distribution centers have become death traps as nearly 1,000 Gazans have been killed there by Israeli live fire in recent weeks. The World Food Programme has called the Sunday shooting at its convoy at Zakim Crossing a terrible incident where Israeli gunfire and tanks targeted people trying to access food for their starving families. This comes as Gaza's health ministry says malnutrition has taken the lives of 19 people in the past 24 hours. Israel's military has issued new evacuation orders in central Gaza, forcing more Palestinian residents to flee. The orders cover one of the few areas where international aid organizations operate. They cut off access between Deir al-Balah and the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis, hampering movement for aid groups and civilians in the Gaza Strip. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described the new orders as a devastating blow to humanitarian efforts. OCHA warned that any damage to health clinics, water infrastructure and aid warehouses in the area will have life-threatening consequences. The UN body noted that the new orders leave 2.1 million civilians squeezed into a fragmented 12% of the Gaza Strip, where essential services have already collapsed. Over 100 Palestinian aid seekers have been killed in a single day in Gaza in what many see as Israel's blatant disregard for human rights and international law. According to Gaza Civil Defense, Israeli troops opened fire on crowds of Palestinians trying to collect humanitarian aid north of Gaza City on Sunday, killing 86 people and wounding dozens more. 13 others were shot dead near an aid distribution center in Rafah, southern Gaza, while 4 more were killed near another aid site in Khan Yunis, also in the south. According to Gaza's medical sources, the number of casualties in what is known as death traps of aid distribution sites has reached nearly 1,000 since late May. The sources say all victims were civilians attempting to access food aid before the distribution sites were turned into killing zones. They say the aid seekers are targeted in direct sniper and gunfire attacks by Israeli forces in a blatant violation of international humanitarian law and human rights principles. Human rights activist Mohsen Arabi joined us earlier with his take on the Israeli massacre of Palestinians near 8 distribution centers in Gaza. Let us take a listen.
In a broader context, I think it's important to understand that 100 were killed today, but in these so-called death traps, over 875 innocent Palestinians have been killed in these death traps, especially the ones that are run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, known as GHF. But I think to really get into the context of why this is happening, we've got to understand U.S. complicity in the genocide. And if we have one solid, overt evidence to the kind of influence that the U.S. empire has in facilitating and expanding the genocide, it's the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is the org that is responsible for distributing this so-called humanitarian aid. The executive chairman of the GHF, which is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, is Johnny Moore Jr. He is an American evangelical Christian leader and also a businessman. He has very close ties with Netanyahu and also by President Trump. And